and welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Amalia. And over here, looking perfect in her little bed, is Lilliput.
And today I'm following down the rabbit hole from the end of episode 27 to the CIA, MKUltra, and Candy Jones. Just kind of briefly talking about those things, because each step in this thing could be, it's just too much.
Okay.
The spider web is never ending.
So last year, John and I took a trip to Nevada and Utah, and we came across a couple treasures there. And I will be talking about a couple of the places we visited and some interesting things I found out about them.
That was so long ago now.
I know.
Back in October.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe sometimes.
Spooky season. Rehash.
Time flies.
Speaking of flying, the very strange, you know, viral video of the jellyfish UFO thing.
Ugh, you showed that to me before bed last night, and it just creeped me out.
So it's reportedly footage recorded over a military base in Iraq in 2018 and was released by Jeremy Corbell. In the video, you can see the strange shaped thing hovering and changing color from black to white to gray from the thermal camera, so it's changing temperature. I don't really know about any of this stuff. But it was also said that they could not lock onto it as a target, which is really weird. So this is an article, little pieces from an article of Irish Star. So the craft was said to have legs dangling beneath it, hence the description of it resembling a jellyfish. Now, the article from Irish Star also stated that a former Marine, Michael Kinkoski, has come forward to say that the supposed UFO, which he and colleagues called the Spaghetti Monster, was spotted on several occasions near the military base. It kind of just ended up being like the ghost story of the base, he told News Nation. Now, the released video only shows a portion of the original 17-minute runtime, but Kinkowski admitted that one of his colleagues, a fellow team member, saw multiple recordings of the apparent UFO. Now, there was also claims from Corbell and others that it went underwater for a period of time and then flew off. But Kinkowski says there isn't a whole lot in the rest of the video, he admitted. It seemingly continued into the distance and got smaller and smaller, whether that was because the sensor was zooming out or it was getting further away, I don't know. But at no point could you see it drop into the water and shoot off into the sky, as there have been some claims. Then, on Instagram, I saw from UFO Secrecy, they shared a news article from Thursday, July 1st, 1954, called Flying Jellyfish Tailed Plane Crewmen Report.
Marine alert, Sherbrooke. July 1st, the crew of a British airliner reported the plane was followed last night for 80 miles by seven weird flying black objects near Goose Bay, Labrador. Captain James Howard, pilot of the New York to London airliner, said the mysterious escort vanished when a U.S. Air Force plane came up to investigate. The British Overseas Airways Corp. Strat cruiser was at 19,000 feet, about 150 miles southwest of Goose Bay, when the object appeared. They flashed into sight suddenly and obviously were not aircraft as we know them, Captain Howard said. All appeared black, and I will swear they were solid. They might have been 5 miles away. They stayed with us 18 minutes. There was a big central object which appeared to keep changing shape. Flying jellyfish, we dubbed it. Sometimes it was wedge-shaped, sometimes like a dumbbell, sometimes like a sphere with a tail-like projections. The six smaller objects dodged about either in front or behind. All 10 members of the crew agreed with his description, as did those of the 51 passengers who were awake at the time of the sighting.
So that was just a cool story. And then that old article Plus it talking about the kind of shape-shiftiness. I heard that like it couldn't be seen by the naked eye, that it was just like picked up by these thermal kind of cameras. And that has been haunting me. I'm always thinking about weird stuff. So now I'm just like, there could be an invisible jellyfish straight from the Black Lodge hovering right next to me at any second. It's pretty fun. All right, well, let's get into it. I wanted to bring that up because I just came across it. You know, I'm late to the party, you know, with all UFO things lately. But it was too fun and weird to not at least bring it.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. So last fall, John and I went with my family. We went to Nevada and Utah. So some of the things I'm going to be talking about today is the Valley of Fire State Park, which we visited, Grafton, Utah, which is a ghost town, and some interesting things I learned about Lake Mead, which is right next to Valley of Fire State Park.
Very cool. Yeah, that was such a fun trip. It was beautiful and eerie and cool, and I loved it.
So the Valley of Fire State Park is an out-of-this-world treasure. It's about 47 miles from Las Vegas. The park is around 46,000 acres and sees around 300,000 visitors each year. It is nestled next to the Moapabana Paiute tribe, and the park has a long history with indigenous peoples. The basket maker culture was in this area around 2,500 years ago, followed later by the early Pueblo culture. Settlers encountered the Paiute tribe around 1865 when they started to encroach on the land. They believed the basket maker culture used the land for hunting, food gathering, and religious ceremonies. John and I visited the park in early fall, and while the Pacific Northwest was around 40 degrees, the Valley of Fire was still 90. I was not expecting it to be that hot. So I can't even imagine what this place is like in the dead of summer. And when I looked it up, it says it can get up to 120 degrees in the summer. It can be very dangerous. So as you probably assume, a lot of people go missing or die in the park because they are not prepared for the temperatures, whether it be high heat or hypothermia. While we were visiting the Valley of Fire, I kept thinking about missing 411 in the back of my mind. Now, if you're not familiar with Missing 411, it's books and shows by David Politis that detail stories of people who go missing in and around national parks. And I did find some instances of visitors dying or some going missing into the park, but that was due to lack of preparedness from what I could find. So I did find an old cold case file from coldcasefiles.com. It is of Raymond Dean Schertz. He was 74 years old when he vanished in November of 2005. He left on Saturday, November 26th from his home in Cedar City, Utah, and he told his sister and daughter that he was going to visit his children in Escalante, which is about a two-hour drive. Now, Dean was actually restricted by his family from driving due to dementia, but he had somehow found his keys that they had hidden. Now, in Fillmore, Utah, which is about an hour and a half away from Cedar City, Raymond was issued a citation for driving the wrong direction on the freeway. Now, he was in his green 1996 Ford Ranger pickup. That is just a completely different direction from where he said he was going to go. Now, witnesses part of a drilling crew reported seeing that vehicle parked at a same location 4 days in a row, and this was outside the Valley of Fire State Park, which is around 4 hours away from Dean's last seen location.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. They reported seeing a man in the car. They could not verify whether or not it was Dean. So on December 1st, 2005, law enforcement found Schertz's vehicle. It was parked off Interstate 15 near the park. Now, the car was locked when police arrived at the scene, and all that they could find was a few footsteps by the vehicle. but nothing else.
Hmm.
There were multiple searches of the area with bloodhounds and helicopter surveillance. Now, back then, Raymond's family was offering $1,000 reward for any kind of information, but searching this area was incredibly hard. It's a hard terrain. There's even old mine shafts that people who are on the ground searching have to be careful of. The weather could be unpredictable, and even the roads were hard to navigate. Now, nothing ever came of the search. Nothing was ever found of him. And in 2020, Utah Cold Case Coalition dived into his case, and they reported that sadly, around 1,000 to 5,000 people can go missing in the deserts in the U.S. every year. Now, Raymond's family, they want closure, but they have kind of come to terms with the fact that he may have just walked off and sadly passed away, and his remains are somewhere in the Valley of Fire State Park.
Jeez.
What's odd is it's December, and if somebody gets hypothermia, when he gets to a certain level of hypothermia, you know, they tend to take off articles of their clothing, but they didn't find anything, and the dogs never picked up on anything. It's almost like he vanished, or they wonder if maybe he got a ride with someone somehow.
That sounds a little more
likely.
I also was wondering if the people who saw his car 4 days in a row, were they saying that it was just like continually parked there?
Just always in the same spot.
But they saw him.
They saw a man sitting in the car one day, but they did not get close enough look as they're driving by to know if it was him. And he was all over the news in the area around that time, so, yeah.
Your mom found something about a giant sloth creature or something in the Valley of Fire?
Darnell Ackhurst, a paranormal enthusiast, makes claims that he saw a giant sloth walking in and around the Red Rocks at Valley Fire State Park. Giant sloths roamed Nevada about 8 million years ago. Darnell says that when he saw the giant sloth, it dematerialized almost instantly, and when he snapped a photo, there was no image of a sloth in it. Locals also claim that they sometimes see strange lights in the sky at the Valley of Fire State Park. One visitor claimed that his uncle was on vacation in Vegas, and he went to the Valley of Fire State Park. While he was hiking around the mighty red rocks, he claims he saw an attractive woman hiking in front of him. The woman smiled, and in his mind, she was telling him to follow her. George says that he heard a woman's voice in his head say, "Follow me."
Oh, God.
George says something wasn't right about this woman and turned around and headed back to his vehicle. He felt something sinister about the woman. When he started walking back to his car, he turned around and couldn't see her.
Ooh. Good job not following, by the way. Good job, George.
Now, when we were at the Valley of Fire State Park, we tried to go to Lake Mead, but we couldn't find it from the area that we exited the park. And I looked it up, and Lake Mead is about 20 minutes from the park. Now, this lake has actually been on my radar for a while. It is the largest reservoir in the U.S., and it was formed by the Hoover Dam on the Colorado River. I didn't know that it provides water to over 20 million people in three states. Now, Lake Mead seems to be pretty dangerous, and actually just last year, 20 people drowned in Lake Mead. Now, in recent years, due to drought, the reservoir has dwindling water levels, and an old ghost town has actually resurfaced. It's the town of St. Thomas. And another thing which I didn't know is that Lake Mead was home to the Anasazi people who left behind what they called the ruins of a lost city. It was an elaborate site, and their houses sometimes had 20 rooms or more, and one even had more than 100 rooms. It was a really interesting mix, I guess, of living styles that were just in the lost city. But tragically, they did not preserve it, and it is now buried under Lake Mead.
That's weird.
Yeah. Back then, scientists were working, I guess, to the last second to try and get a lot of the artifacts that they found there. They found, like, pottery, some remains, a lot of tools. In a nearby cave, they found you know, just a lot of things that they use for like hunting tools. So they did preserve some of those, but they never actually preserved the city. So it's a tragedy. I wish they would have found a way. In 2022, water levels of Lake Mead dropped to a historic low due to a long drought. And it led to the discovery of around 6 sets of human remains. Now, most of those people, they were able to identify them as people who are drowning victims. But there was one body that was found in a barrel. And it has the remains of a man who died of a gunshot wound around 40 to 50 years ago. Now, due to backlog, he remains unidentified. Now, Zach Bagans actually investigated the area of Lake Mead. Due to paranormal activity.
Is that what you call it? Investigated?
Now, Quarter Way of Boulder Spook Finders says that when his team conducted an investigation of Lake Mead, they captured EVPs of people screaming. Many of his team members saw shadow people, and one of his female team members had her leg grabbed. Lake Mead is filled with dark energy, and it's not a place for the faint of heart. Carter says that when his team was ready to quit their investigation, they heard distant drum beats echoing into the night. He believes the drum beats were from Native American spirits.
As they would be.
From what I could find, Lake Mead does seem to have a lot of interesting things going on with it. So I'm going to bookmark it, though, and I want to dive into that in a later episode. So to be continued on the topic of Lake Mead. For the last thing I want to talk about, we visited a very famous ghost town called Grafton, which is outside the Zion National Park in Utah. Now, this town was actually used for the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's really cool. It's you go kind of go down this old dirt road, and then it's just there, just all by itself. Some of the houses that they had have been preserved. Some of them, they were in disarray, and they were able to kind of bring it back to what they imagined it looked like at the height of its glory. So the settlers, led by Nathan Tenney, settled in Grafton in late 1859, and they use the land as part of a southern Utah cotton growing project, which was ordered by Brigham Young, who had called on hundreds of families to relocate to southwestern Utah to help establish a cotton mission. The goal was to produce enough cotton to supply church members' needs and thereby in reliance upon eastern markets for that product. I don't think they were prepared for how unforgiving the land there can be. Now, the colonizers were very unfamiliar with the terrain and the weather. Right as they arrived, a huge rain moved into the area, and the Virgin River, which ran through Grafton and the surrounding towns, all had high floods that obliterated the first colonizing attempt at the settlement. It swept away the land and nearby towns of Virgin City and Rockville. Now, houses, furniture, clothing, and just properties from there floated down the river. They honestly just had horrible luck there. They had disease outbreaks. There was, you know, a lot of them died from TB back then in the town. And one thing with the farming is that the irrigation dams were repeatedly washed out. Now, this wasn't even from flooding. The irrigation ditches just on the regular filled with sand, and it just required tedious work. One settler wrote, "Making ditches at Grafton is like household washing. It's a weekly chore." There was a lot of conflict with the original people of the land, the Paiutes and the Navajos. Found that their own resources and their land were dwindling due to the Mormon population coming in and taking over. So Grafton had to resettle in nearby Rockville for their safety. They said, Brigham Young said there should be at least 150 men there for them to be safe. So they moved to Rockville, but farmers would go back daily to Grafton to farm. The cotton project didn't really take off. Nothing fruitful happened, and the population began to dwindle by 1921. Now, some people did not leave until 1944, but the flooding and isolation and the elements proved too hard for some of the residents, and a lot just moved away to larger cities, especially as those that were younger. Grafton has a cemetery that is said to be haunted, which we visited.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are 84 known graves in the cemetery, but there are some there that are unmarked, which I didn't catch when we were there. Now, what I found interesting is that the highest the population got around Grafton was around 120. So it's kind of crazy that almost 90 people are buried there. Now, a lot of people leave coins on the graves, mm-hmm. and it's said to show respect and bring good luck. So we left some coins when we were there.
Yeah, so a lot of coins there.
Now, visitors have reported seeing or hearing unexplainable things in the cemetery. Some feel uneasy and like they're being watched. And then some say if it's like a overcast day, they can hear babies crying, little kids laughing, and even people screaming.
The classics.
Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes people have even seen a woman in a calico dress with her hair up in a bun crying at one of the graves. Now, people wonder if maybe she's part of some kind of show there, or they're taking pictures, or just is part of something, you know. But when you approach her, she vanishes.
Yeah, they better pay her well then.
Mm-hmm.
While we were there, we're in one of the little houses, and Amelia's mom started smelling something that she couldn't explain.
Mm, that's right.
Still smell it, Tammy?
Yeah.
It's not just the wood?
No, it's a scent. It's like a flower scent or a spice.
I went downstairs. We went into a little cellar.
Yes, I did not like that cellar.
Try to record some, you know, EVP stuff. But there was people stomping around upstairs and stuff, so I didn't catch anything weird.
Oh, my camera battery got drained pretty fast there. That's the only thing that's odd.
Yeah, that seems to happen a lot. Your camera battery is very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little psychic.
Mm-hmm.
A little psychic battery.
Two instances now where it has drained. Or the memory card just went corrupt for no reason, even though it had worked fine.
Yeah, overall, Nevada and Utah, very cool.
If you ever find yourself in the ghost town of Grafton, and if you see anything strange or hear anything strange, let us know.
So last episode, I ended off with getting into John Neble and Candy Jones and her claims about CIA mind control and pretty much being like the Manchurian candidate. Now, most articles agree that the U.S.'s interest in mind control began with the concern that the Soviets, China, and North Korea were using mind control to brainwash prisoners of war. During the Korean War, some of the POWs returned home and were reciting anti-American and communist propaganda. Now, that was between the years of 1950 and 1953, but it seems that the U.S. was already interested in the development of truth drugs, dating back, at least according to Wikipedia, to 1943. Stating that the American interest in drug-related interrogation experiments began in 1943 when the Office of Strategic Services, better known as OSS, began developing a truth drug that would produce uninhibited truthfulness in an interrogated person. There's also a link to Nazi scientist experiments in the early 1940s. They use substances like barbiturates, morphine, hallucinogens like mescaline, and they use them on Jewish and Russian POWs in the effort to develop a truth serum, which one laboratory assistant said would eliminate the will of the person examined. American historian Stephen Kinzer claims that the CIA project was a continuation of those experiments conducted by Nazi scientists, later employed by the U.S. as part of Operation Paperclip. For those who don't know about Operation Paperclip, it was a secret intelligence program in the U.S. that brought over 1,600 Nazi scientists to work for our government after World War II. In 1947, Project Chatter began. This was an interrogation program that used lysergic acid diethylamide, or more commonly known as LSD, on human subjects. And also, I just want to say 1947, the year of so much weird stuff.
Oh, that's true.
Kenneth Arnold sighting, Maury Island incident, Roswell crash.
Yeah.
The year Aleister Crowley died.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff. In the early 1950s, there was something known as Project Bluebird. This had the same goal of eliminating a person's will. Sidney was a former employee of the Department of Agriculture and the FDA, where he developed tests to measure the presence of drugs in the human body. He reportedly was bored with his work and needed more of a challenge. He found a job with the National Research Council in 1948, where he was exposed to some interesting work concerning ergot alkaloids as vasoconstrictors and hallucinogens. Now, vasoconstrictors are meds that cause the narrowing of blood vessels.
Mm.
We all know what hallucinogens are. A lot of interesting connections to ergot. I think that might be my next topic. It's a fungal disease that affects cereal grasses, especially rye, and it's linked to all sorts of cases of mass hysteria,
what?
Ancient rituals, all sorts of cool stuff. But it has some LSD-like effects. I don't know all the scientific stuff yet, but I think I'm going to be getting into ergot next. Back to it. July 13th, 1951 was Sidney's first day at work for the CIA. Project Bluebird was already in progress. Alan Dulles was deputy director for plans at the time. He brought Sidney on, and within a short period of time, he was named chief of the newly formed chemical division, and Project Bluebird was renamed to Project Artichoke, was expanded and centralized, and Alan Dulles shortly after became deputy director of the CIA. So a bunch of all the pieces are coming together now.
Wow.
The goal of the project can be summed up in this CIA interdepartmental memo from 1952. Controlling an individual to the point where he will do our bidding against his will and even against such fundamental laws of nature as self-preservation. Keeps getting darker like that. MK Ultra was approved in 1953. So lots of experiments with LSD and various other drugs, including THC, cocaine, mescaline, psilocybin, as well as paralytics, which are powerful muscle relaxants used to prevent muscle movement during surgical procedures, and electroshock therapy.
Oh my God.
Many of these tests took place at universities, hospitals, and prisons in the U.S. and Canada between 1953 and 1964. Some notable folks who participated in these MK Ultra experiments were Ken Kesey, author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He volunteered for MK Ultra experiments with LSD while he was a college student at Stanford University, later conducting LSD-fueled parties known as acid tests, which helped spark the 60s psychedelic scene. So all of some of my favorite music comes from MKUltra experiments, probably. Others included Robert Hunter, lyricist for the Grateful Dead. No surprise there.
Yeah.
Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. Oh. And the Boston mobster James Joseph Whitey Bulger.
Oh.
I'm currently looking into the links to Charles Manson in Tom O'Neill's book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. I'm still just at the Charles Manson part, so I'm pretty sure it's going to get wild. So much craziness in all this already that I just had to like fly over Ted Kaczynski as part of the experiments. Yeah. So let's get into some of the sub-projects under the MK Ultra umbrella.
Okay.
There's lots of them. Operation Midnight Climax. Government-employed sex workers led unsuspecting men to CIA safe houses where they were dosed with LSD and then observed through two-way mirrors, and recording devices were installed in the rooms disguised as electrical outlets. Yes, I am trying to make you all paranoid. Ugh. As paranoid as me, I should say.
Yeah, I already get worried about two-way mirrors at hotels or any kind of surveillance at an Airbnb.
It's even easier now.
Yeah.
And they were doing it then, so. These took place in San Francisco, California, and New York City. I've seen claims that it was more like a party-like atmosphere with the CIA agents drinking cocktails and partying on the other side of the mirrors.
Mm.
Not just drinking cocktails either.
Yeah.
An agent named George White, who, another character, George White at the time was operating under the pseudonym of Morgan Hall, wrote to Gottlieb in 1971. He said, "Of course, I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic, but I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, and cheat, steal, deceive, rape, and pillage with the sanction and blessing of the All-Highest?" So this is the attitude of the type of people that were running these programs.
It's untouchable is how they felt.
So they ran these safe houses in San Francisco from 54 to 65, and the New York one closed in 66. The idea was for the sex workers to bring them into the safe houses, give them drugs, and then after intercourse, they would question them, even feeding them subliminal messages to see if they could get people to reveal secrets.
Wow.
They also did lots of other experiments at these safe houses. One of which I read included combining LSD and isolation, where the subjects would be dosed and isolated for months with minimal food and water and then just observed, like in these rooms. Oh, insane. All right, now let's go to subproject 68. Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron developed his theory of psychic driving in 1953 to attempt to cure schizophrenia. This consisted of loops of recordings for up to 16 hours a day, 10 days of negative personal messages, followed by 10 days of positive messages. Obviously, these are the kind of ideas that the CIA was foaming at the mouth for. He was recruited by the CIA in 1957 and was paid $69,000 through the front company, Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology. Always be concerned with these kind of very vague names. They'll end up selling black market body parts or something crazy. These experiments were conducted in Canada, many being at the Allen Memorial Institute. Patients would go there for treatments for other ailments such as asthma and ended up being put in medical-induced comas with psychic driving and electroshock.
Wow.
Now, I saw lots of articles and documentaries about this, but here's some quotes from people involved, from family members of people that came back from the Allen. "My dad was at the Royal Victorian Asthma Clinic, and they told him if he went to the Allen, they could cure his asthma. Well, that didn't happen. He went in there and had 54 high-voltage shock treatments, followed by 54 grand mal seizures. He had been put in an insulin coma with a recording going around, 'Your mother hates you.'" Now, that's from one of the family members who was organizing a movement to get them to be responsible for this. And that was from co-organizer Lana Mills Sochucks.
What a weird audio to play on repeat. It's almost like the person who decided that, their mom probably hated them.
Quite possibly. So 77 victims received compensation from the Canadian government in 1992 for experimental treatments by Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron at the Allen Memorial Institute. The treatments included torture techniques involving drug-induced comas, intensive electroshock therapy aimed at reprogramming the brain. The Montreal-based psychiatrist received funding from the Canadian government and the American Central Intelligence Agency. They admitted it. Canadian government paid money to the families and the docs. It's very sad, but they came back and totally different. They came back violent many of the times. They were just normal, happy people. They would come back just
disturbed.
Just absolutely not even the same person. Weirdly enough, while reading that News of the Weird book during the last episode, I told you about the Fighting Firemen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I flipped to a random page and read this. The Central Intelligence Agency once hired a magician as a consultant to a project on behavior to see if he could explain things people had a hard time trying to explain. That was in quotes. Until his death in 1970, he also helped to write a manual for agents in using sleight of hand and administering drugs to unsuspecting persons. The agency had also asked him to analyze the work of a mystic who the agency said had devised a system for sending and receiving telepathic messages anywhere in the world. I wish they would use some names, but it might be kind of fun to figure out who that was. Well, I ended up running into the magician while researching this topic. John Mulholland and the Official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception. Now, he was a famous magician starting his career in 1913. He ran one of the first magic workshops and was the editor of the magical trade magazine, The Sphinx. He wrote tons of books, including a book of spells for soldiers during World War II. He knew Houdini, and he also, like Houdini, was all about exposing the fraudulent spiritualist mediums. In 1939, he was the only foreign officer in the British Magical Society, and by that time had studied his craft in 42 countries. He left the editorial position at the Sphinx in 1953, officially due to health problems, but he was actually working for, you guessed it, the CIA. The manual he wrote was supposedly destroyed in 1973, with most of the documents from all the sub-projects of MKUltra. I think there was, I read, 149 sub-projects. But this manual resurfaced later, so someone kept one, obviously. The table of contents reads, handling of tablets, handling of powders, handling of liquids, surreptitious removal of objects, special aspects of deception for women, surreptitious removal of objects by women, and working as a team. The purpose of this manual was to assist agents with straight up secretly drugging folks, you know, deceiving, using sleight of hand, probably assassinating people. But yeah, absolutely wild stuff. Not to mention, I randomly flipped to that in the News of the Weird and then found it. So pretty cool. Another sink. And now finally to Candy Jones. Last we left, we talked about Long John Neville. We talked about Candy Jones. Go back and listen to episode 27 if you need a little refresher for that. But Candy Jones was a very famous pinup model. Long John Neville was a famous late night radio host, pre-Art Bell type of radio host. And him and Candy were friends. He was a photographer. They had known each other for years. And then ended up dating, and 28 days later, they got married. Now here's them talking about it a little.
We always used to be friends. We used to talk, and we didn't date. He used to call every now and then and say, how are you? And I'd say, how are you, and so forth. And I was in California, and I saw this terrible thing in a newspaper with a black box around it. And it was a frightening item. And I called New York, checked it out, found out that it was, nobody knew about it actually in New York, but it was something that had come out. And I showed even more interest in him.
What did the black box say?
It said that he was a victim of cancer.
And would be giving up broadcasting.
And that was it. And this healthy, vigorous man I'd known for so long, I mean, it just didn't seem possible. So anyway, we used to talk on the phone, as I said. And one night he said, "Do you ever think of getting married again?" I knew I wasn't. And I said, "Nope." And he said, "How come?" I said, "Nobody's asked me." And he said, "Would you want to?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "Why? What'd you have in mind?" He said, "How'd you like to marry me?" Stop me if I'm wrong.
No, this is true.
You're doing fine so far, Candy.
And she obviously gave the right answer, would you not think?
Yeah. So I said, "Well, I have to take the dog for a walk, and I'll give you my answer." Woof, woof, woof. And no, I said, "Yeah, great, fine." I said, "I'll call you back as soon as I bring the dog back." Well, the dog and I went for a run. The dog ran me, and we ran back, and we decided not to wait the usual 6 months or anything. As a matter of fact, to be very honest, I mean, it's just four of us here, he had never even held my hand, let alone kiss me.
I never had coffee with her or anything.
You're the romantic type, eh, John?
Yeah. Well, I know her. I used to be a professional photographer many years ago, and although I never hired the model is hired by the agency. And she was doing a lot of work for Borden Milk Company, and I was the photographer for them. So she was a model for me, and I got to know her that way. And so that was the romance, and here she is, lucky her, sitting here being married to Long John.
Guess what?
I envy both of you.
Fortean Times says during the reception, he noticed a curious change come over her. Within a very short time, she lost all her natural charm and exuberance. Her voice changed to that of another woman entirely, and her normal fluid posture stiffened. While preparing for bed, Candy began speaking again in the voice Nebel had heard earlier. Even more alarming, this strange personality within Candy had a completely different attitude towards him. She sounded cruel, mocking, and cold. When Nebel asked her about it, Candy was astonished. She hadn't noticed the emergence of another voice or personality. Now, weeks later into their marriage, she tells Nebel that she had worked for the FBI for some time, adding mysteriously that she might have to go out of town on occasion without giving a reason. Now, Candy was born Jessica Wilcox in Atlantic City, New Jersey in 1925. According to Fortean Times, her parents were terribly abusive, and her mother would sometimes lock her in a dark room. This is reportedly where Candy developed a family of fantasy figures to keep her company. Fortean Times says she visualized these characters appearing in the twilight reflections of a large wall mirror. The name of one of these magical friends was Arlene, and she was to figure crucially in Candy's later life. Unlike the other figures of this imagined world, Arlene didn't fade away with Candy's childhood. So Candy was sweet, but Arlene would step in when she needed someone. Candy seemed to be scared of anything Chinese, and especially anything to do with drugs. Whenever they were mentioned by doctors or dentists, Arlene would appear and deny that anything should enter her body. Like she's talking about Candy.
Oh my God.
Now, Nebel was an amateur hypnotist, so he took things into his own hands and decided to put Candy into a trance, ask some questions, and tape the results. More about this can be found in Donald Bain's book, The Control of Candy Jones, which I definitely have not yet read. But the story goes, kind of summarized from 40 in times. While touring military bases in 1945, Candy fell sick in the Philippines and was admitted to a hospital in Leyte Gulf. There she met Dr. Gilbert Jensen. He gave her vitamin injections that saved her life, gave her his card, and requested that she write to him. In 1960, after her divorce to fashion czar Harry Conover, who was in jail for fraud, Candy ran her own fashion business in New York. There she was approached by the FBI, who asked if they could use her office space as a mail drop. She agreed and also began to deliver mail for the FBI while traveling on business. She thought of it as her patriotic duty. One of her first tasks, delivering a letter to a man in San Francisco, the Dr. Gilbert Jensen, same one who once saved her life. So they had dinner, and he encouraged her to get deeper into the covert intelligence business. Her being a single mother with three sons, all in private school, agreed. Now, Jensen worked for, you guessed it, the CIA. Gilbert hypnotized Candy and found Arlene. He developed this other personality using hypnotic suggestion and injecting her with experimental drugs. The idea was to use Arlene to assist Candy with going on these secret missions where she could become the perfect messenger and never give up the secrets, even under torture.
Oh my God.
Candy was trained all over America in explosives, close combat, weaponry, disguise, and communications, how to kill with her bare hands, as well as being conditioned to resist pain. Jensen was proud of his creation, showing off his perfect warrior, and it said that he illustrated his point by inserting a lit candle into Candy's body, also in the way that you are thinking. And he did this to prove the resistance to pain in front of 24 doctors in an auditorium at the CIA headquarters. She was sent to Taiwan at least twice on test missions, where she was tortured and sexually abused to see if she would crack. Now, I'm not going to get into any more of those kind of details, but it is in the article from 40 in Times that I will link. Candy knew nothing of these trips, just that she would meet Jensen and deliver mail. The rest was blank. Jensen took her out of the trance and she was back to normal. Now, this story is only known from the audio tapes of Candy speaking under hypnosis and being questioned by Nebel. Also, a couple fact checks and some extra stuff. Jensen did indeed exist and was certainly engaged in the kind of activity that Candy described. Donald Bain said that. They attempted to get more info about Jensen through various means, one being Nebel dressing like him and pretending to be him while Candy was under hypnosis, but I guess Arlene knew better and was trained to never crack or reveal info.
Wow.
Donald Bain checked out her office attendance hours throughout the 1960s, and over a period of 10 years, she was frequently absent under the cover of business trips on which it appeared no business was done. Bain believed that there was a good possibility that this work had not stopped. Now, whether or not any of the hypnotic trance statements are true, I have no clue. But with the lineup of the time, absences from work, the other personality Arlene, and what we learned about the various projects and goals of the CIA, that doesn't sound that fantastical to me. Possibly exaggerated, but who knows?
Yeah. I will say I would not put it past our government to do something like that.
Amalia's got us put on a list now. So I will say, you know, researching this stuff was so interesting. But it also did some of that stuff that I was concerned about. Falling down the rabbit hole a little too deep. Looking at my outlets a little bit more than I should. It's like, if a lot of this stuff is real and there's records of it, who knows what was burned? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. Check the show notes for all relevant links to today's episode. Lots of CIA-related stuff. To support the show, you can join the Strange Pals Club at patreon.com/anomalouswaves. Rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us at Anomalous Waves on Instagram. Or go to anomalouswaves.com for all them links, including ways to contact us, merch stuff, Spotify playlists, and all that other jazz. But the best way to support the show is to tell someone about it. Tell a black floating creature craft with tentacles.
Tell a giant sloth that disappears when you try and take their photo.
Talk about our podcast onto a recording that is then looped and played for hours on end.
Tell a ghost crying at a cemetery.
Or just tell anyone who likes anything weird. Okay, we're going to end the episode with Amalia hitting that liminal.earth map random story function.
So this story is from February of 2021. Shadow person and energy drain. I had been living at this address with my roommates, my friend and his girlfriend, for over a year without any weirdness, until one day when I got home from work. Their room and my room were in a half basement with a landing leading to both. You would come down the stairs and there were two doors straight ahead leading to their room and my room, and a door to the left leading to the bathroom. Their room had a walk-through closet which connected to the bathroom, and they kept the door to the closet closed at most times. As I got home, I went straight to my room as I usually did, and my buddy came down to say hi. His girlfriend, as usual, was at work, and he and the animals were all upstairs in the living room watching TV. As we were talking, I had casually looked into his room where the light from the hall was landing on his wall, and I saw a shadow pass along like someone was walking around in there. I'm a veteran, and being the Midwesterners we are, living in a less than nice part of town and remembering that someone a few blocks down had been murdered in a break-in a month or two prior, I retrieved my gun, and he kept an eye on his room and then went in carefully, turning on the lights, as I did, and nothing. No one in the closet, no one in the bathroom, and he would have seen someone leaving the bathroom on the other side. Nothing had been touched, and nothing was missing. The only thing we had seen was a shadow of a man on the wall, and it hadn't been either of us who had been standing there talking about the day. It wasn't the shadow of anyone from outside either, because it was around midnight and the only light entering his room had been from the hall where he had been, and we both saw it. I know about shadow people, but had never seen one before. We were a little uneasy, but the night went on without further incident, and as humans are in the face of weirdness, we put it out of our minds with a gaming session or five, and then we went to bed. That wasn't our last experience with it, though. Similar incidents happened over the following months. One afternoon, I had an earlier shift and got home earlier than usual. I was tired. But as someone approaching 30 and working a semi-manual labor job, I'm used to it. What I am not used to, however, is suddenly and rapidly being drained of all energy and involuntarily collapsing. Not into unconsciousness, just collapsing, as if someone had removed all of my muscles and I was just a loose bag of bone and tissue. You ever play with one of those toys as a kid that's a string going through a bunch of blocks or something, but if you pull the string at the bottom, it tightens into a figure, and if you let go of the string, it collapses? Yeah, it was like that. I laid there for probably a good 15 minutes before my buddy came down to say his usual hi and saw me just laying there. He worriedly asked if I was okay, and I told him that I collapsed and didn't have the energy to move but was otherwise fine. I had run through math facts and other logic puzzles to check my mental faculties while I had been alone, and everything checked out. But I wasn't exaggerating when I told him I couldn't move. I quite literally could not move a voluntary muscle, not so much as my pinky toe. I was effectively paralyzed. He asked if I wanted him to call an ambulance, and I declined. I wasn't in pain, and as far as I could tell, wasn't in any immediate danger. I could still feel the floor beneath me, where it was connected with my body, and I could feel the temperature of the room like normal. I just couldn't move. He sat there with me for maybe a half hour, and gradually I was able to regain movement. Slowly at first, and then able to sit up and drink a glass of water, and then finally stand up and walk around again. We didn't know what had happened and just chalked it up to weirdness. Honestly, it wasn't even until now, typing this about the shadow person we had encountered in his room, that I had even thought to connect the two incidents. I collapsed just outside my room in the landing, right where we had been standing when we had seen the figure. I don't know if they're connected, but I figured I'd submit them together on the chance others have had similar experience or coincidence.
Wow, weird, and what a great writer. Who submitted that?
Isaac from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Submitted it on December 8th, 2022. Dark forces, high weirdness, straight up ghosts.
All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.
See you later, alligators. Lilliput.